This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Sound recording and editing was by Tom Hayes of Anglia Ruskin University, Cambridge. Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge.
On the 12th of November 2008, I introduced the third session of the General Theory Reading Group with a talk on the theme Measuring Income and Capital. The talk is based on Chapter 2 of my book The Economics of Keynes, A New Guide to the General Theory, published by Edward Elgar. You can also download a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
So, Book 2 is the part of the general theory that I suspect very few people have read. Alvin Hansen wrote in his Guide to Keynes that the section on income is of no great importance for an understanding of the general theory and may quite well be omitted if the student so wishes, unquote. Which is most ironic, given the importance and amount of attention that Keynes gives to the definition of income in these chapters. Book 2 is hard going, because much of it's alien to classical thought, and I found it necessary to devote one quarter of my own guide to it. And I hope this will not deter you from coming next time. Today I'll look at GT chapters 4, 6 and 7, which concern the measurement of income and capital and the question of the relationship between saving and investment. I will have to devote the whole of the next reading group session to the 6 pages of GT Chapter 5 on the relationship between expectation and output. So the title of GT Chapter 4 is The Choice of Units. In the last session, I introduced you to the principle of effective demand and Keynes's aggregate supply and demand functions, Z and D. Why did he have to invent these functions, and how do they relate to traditional supply and demand curves? If you recall, the aggregate demand function, D, relates the total money income expected by industry as a whole to the total level of employment, N, where the direction of causation runs from employment to income. The aggregate supply function, Z, relates the total expected money income to the total level of employment, N, where the direction of causation runs from expected income to employment. And the intersection of the aggregate demand and supply functions determines, as equilibrium values, the effective demand, which we called D star, and the level of employment, which we call N star. So to recap, the point of effective demand can be illustrated by the intersection in the so-called Z diagram. The Z and D curves represent Keynes's aggregate supply and demand functions. Note that these bear no resemblance to the versions you find in textbooks, for reasons that will become clear. In this diagram, the horizontal axis is employment, the vertical is expected money income. Thus, the Z curve represents the expected income required to maximise the profits of entrepreneurs in their capacity as employers of labour at any given level of employment. And the D curve is the income that entrepreneurs in their capacity as dealers in goods would expect to arise from expenditure on consumption and investment corresponding to any given level of employment. So the actual income expected at any time is given by the intersection of the two curves, the effective demand. Now, why expected money income and not supply or demand price as in the usual diagram? The problem in a nutshell is Q, or O, as Keynes prefers to denote output. Keynes addresses a question so fundamental that it's been ignored by almost everyone since. How do you measure the quantity of current output when output and capital are not homogeneous, as in a simple corn model? It's important to establish immediately that an index of output will not do. An index is a weighted average of the quantities of different types of homogeneous goods, where the weights are usually prices. Mathematically, an index is a scalar transformation into a single number of a vector or set of heterogeneous quantities. Now, indices have an important place in historical and statistical analysis, but you can't differentiate an index, and you cannot assume as weights the prices whose equilibrium values you are seeking to determine. The problem is not simply one of the aggregation of different kinds of output. It extends even to the definition of the output of a single firm. And here I part company from Michael Ambrosi, who spoke 3 weeks ago. For consider even our corn farmer. If he starts with a tractor, a ton of diesel, and half a ton of seed corn, and ends up after harvest with a slightly older tractor, half a ton of diesel, 7 tons of corn, and 5 tons of straw, what is his net output in physical terms? There is simply no single numerical answer that we can call his net or current output. The problem of measuring current output is the question of how much of today's sales represents today's production, and how much is in some sense output brought forward from previous periods. Indeed, this corresponds directly to the problem of measuring current investment, that is, present production, that is carried forward in some form for consumption in the future. And note that for the economy as a whole, saving has to take physical, not financial form. Now, Hansen and the whole host of macroeconomists have simply written Y to represent real output and moved on to the next question, including writing K for physical capital and combining it with labour in an aggregate production function. But the fact that you can define something does not mean that it exists. As Keynes puts it, to say that net output today is greater, but the price level lower, than 10 years ago or 1 year ago, is a proposition of a similar character to the statement that Queen Victoria was a better queen, but not a happier woman than Queen Elizabeth. A proposition not without meaning, and not without interest, but unsuitable as material for the differential calculus. Our precision will be a mock precision if we try to use such partly vague and non-quantitative concepts as the basis of a quantitative analysis. And since there is no solution to the conundrums created by trying to compare numerically two, quote, incommensurable collections of miscellaneous objects, unquote, Keynes works in only two units of measure, money value and labour. The aggregate demand and supply functions are designed to overcome the problem that the price and output of industry as a whole, and especially the current output arising from the activity of the current period, cannot be defined as single numbers. The functions are specified in terms of labour and money income, which can be so defined with the help of the concept of user cost. And furthermore, there's an empirical realism about this approach in that money, income and labour are all that entrepreneurs need in practice to make employment and investment decisions. It is because economists have not seen the point of Keynes's concern here that they have failed to understand his aggregate supply and demand functions, and the key concept on which they are based, user cost. I think user cost is probably the last straw where my classical, and indeed many post-Keynesian colleagues, throw up their hands and consign me to the ranks of the alchemists and astrologers. But user cost is simply the value of the consumption, or using up, of goods by firms in the course of production, rather than by consumers in the course of household consumption. The neglect of user cost has led to the view that income can be defined equally well either as the value of current output, which is how Keynes defines it on page 63, or as the value of expenditure, with serious consequences that I will come to later. Now, demand in a monetary economy arises in money terms, so that demand for the output of each industry can properly be added together to arrive at the demand for the output of industry as a whole. But an adjustment is required to the aggregate value of demand to convert expenditure into a measure of aggregate expected money income. And that adjustment is the deduction of user cost. Thus, Keynes's aggregate demand differs from the traditional Keynesian aggregate demand on two accounts. Firstly, because it is a measure of income, not expenditure. And secondly, because it is income expected by entrepreneurs, not expenditure planned by consumers and investors. This second point we will address further in the next session on chapter 5. Now, there's no Marshallian equivalent of the aggregate demand function. But the aggregate supply function can be defined equally well for a firm, an individual industry, or industry as a whole. In that sense, the name is an unfortunate choice. The aggregate supply price, Z, little r, differs from the Marshallian unit supply price, P, because ZR is a measure of expected income, or proceeds, as Keynes calls it, net of user cost. The proceeds are the total income of the entrepreneur and the factors of production taken together, which is maximized when marginal proceeds equals marginal factor cost. The aggregate supply function also differs from Marshall's ordinary supply function in relating a measure of expected income not to output but to employment, which is a close proxy for output and can realistically be treated as homogeneous in the short term where output cannot. Nevertheless, the two concepts can be connected, as these equations show, in the case of a single firm or industry which does have a single defined product, O sub R. The importance of the aggregate supply function is that it can properly be defined for industry as a whole, as the sum of its parts. You can add together all the little z's. The expected income of each firm being a money value, these can be added to those of other firms to give aggregate expected income. And similarly, the employment of each firm can be added together to give aggregate employment. So Keynes's expected money income functions, Z and D, overcome at a stroke the problems of aggregation and the valuation of output and capital which had beset the sophisticated Marshallian analysis of his time. Contrary to the quip attributed to Gerald Shove that Maynard never did take the half hour necessary to understand the theory of value, Keynes was its master. We have at this stage travelled many leagues from the Keynesian cross. So let's now move on from GT Chapter 4 and take a deeper look at income and capital themselves, as does Keynes in GT Chapters 6 and 7. Now, throughout Keynes's discussion, income, investment and saving are always money values, not merely the nominal values of real quantities. Income is intrinsically monetary. In an economy in which output and capital goods are heterogeneous. In other words, in any productive market economy as opposed to a corn model. Income is the money value of current output. This is common ground between Keynes and the classics. The divergence is over the measurement or existence of the concept of current output in physical terms. When Keynes does refer to real income, which he puts in some sense on page 91, he means money income deflated by the wage unit, not a measure of homogeneous output. But nevertheless, it's not the payment as such of money, but the readiness to enter into contracts for value that determines the quantities and prices of output in a monetary economy. A sale occurs when a contract to exchange one good for another, usually a sum of money, is fulfilled at the agreed price. If the good sold already exists, this contract is an agreement for sale on capital account and does not create income. And nor does the creation of a debt. But if the good sold is to be newly produced, the agreement is, directly or indirectly, an order for factor services and a prelude to income. Income itself arises, or is recognised in accounting terminology, when the newly produced good or service is delivered. Whether on income or capital account, the sale is recorded as taking place on delivery. Now, for economic purposes, income arises when a good is newly produced, whether it is delivered, unquotes, into the firm's own stock, gross investment, or negative user cost, or whether it's delivered to a customer under a sale agreement. Unlike production for stock, a sale creates a money debt, an obligation of the buyer to pay the sum of money specified in the sale agreement, which the buyer must settle either on delivery or at some agreed future date after a period of trade credit. But the sale has been made whether or not the debt is settled. Indeed, if the buyer defaults on the debt, the accountants treat this as a bad debt rather than as a cancellation of the sale which created the debt. Corresponding to the debt from the customer or the newly produced asset held in stock on one side of the balance sheet, there has to be a matching increase in liability on the other side of the balance sheet, where liability can include net worth. Such an increase in net worth is saving. This little accounting lesson is something which most economists do not trifle with. But I think it's really important to understanding what Keynes is actually saying in these chapters. In the case of factors of production, there's no difference of principle. You may receive your salary monthly, if you earn one, but you earn income every day that you go to work, as you soon find out if you leave a job during the middle of the month and find that your final paycheck has been reduced from the previous monthly amount. Every day that you turn up for work creates a debt from your employer which is settled every month. And at the same time, you're incurring expense, perhaps on credit, such as utility bills. And your saving in any period represents the difference between the income earned and the expense accrued, irrespective of whether it's payday or whether you pay your bills. Now let me try and ground this. So in this example, I earn £20 a day. At the beginning of a period of 3 days, I have £100 owed to me for 5 days' work, £200 in the bank, and I owe a utility company £50. My net worth is therefore £250. During the 3 days, I earn £60. I use utilities at a cost of £20, and I consume other goods for £30. My saving for the period is therefore £10. On the other hand, my cash flow for the 3 days is a negative £70, involving a payment to the utility of £40 for a bill that's now due, and £30 for the cash purchase of the other consumption goods. And at the end of the 3 days, my closing balance sheet shows my employer now owes me £160. I have £130 in the bank. I owe the utility company £30, being the £50 I owed them to start with, less £40 paid off, plus a further £20 for gas burned or electricity used or whatever. And my net worth is now £260. So that is to say, my opening net worth of £250 plus £10 saving. In a more complicated case, many a business becomes insolvent with expanding sales and a full order book. Not for a lack of retained earnings, saving, but because of a lack of money on the other side of the balance sheet. You cannot meet a payroll from the retained earnings account. Now, in modern macro, we're taught to think of real income as the physical output of an aggregate production function, of which the inputs are factors of production, i.e. labour and physical capital. Inputs and outputs are simultaneous. We tend to think of capital as machines. By contrast, Keynes and his sophisticated Marshallian colleagues like Pigou and Hawtrey recognised that production is a process through time, and that a large component of capital is not machines, but working capital, i.e. work in progress. Pigou's analogy is rather good, leaving aside the question of how you measure capital. He writes, "Capital may be likened to a lake, into which a great variety of things are continually being projected. Among them are things of long life, like elaborately built factories, things of moderate life, like machinery, and things of very short life, like material designed to be worked up into finished goods, or coal destined to be burned. Length of life in this connection means, of course, length of life as capital in the industrial machine functioning as a going concern. All things that enter the lake eventually pass out of it again. But exits are not always, or indeed generally, made in the form of a passage outward of the actual elements that originally came in. In one form or another, however, whatever enters also leaves." So, production takes time, a production period usually extending over many days, while income arises from day to day, where a day is Keynes's quantum unit of time. You will recall. Thus, in a capital-intensive mode of production, most factor income arises from gross investment, an addition to working capital and other stocks, while most consumption, services apart, represents user cost, a depletion of the capital stock. For example, on Keynes's definitions, the purchase by a consumer of an apple does not add to economic income if we ignore the value added by the retailer. It merely reduces the capital stock. The value of the retailer's sale is matched by an equivalent user cost. By contrast, the harvest of apples does add to income, even though the apples are not sold but put into the farmer's store. Traditional income expenditure Keynesianism has taught us to think of aggregate income as the value of aggregate expenditure. However, you'll find no income expenditure identity in the general theory, only an investment saving identity. Now, the identical equivalence of aggregate investment and saving has puzzled many a generation of first-year students. And the usual explanation is in terms of leakages from a circular flow of income and expenditure, understood essentially as flows of money payments and mixed up vaguely with a multiplier. Keynes's approach is rather different and is based on the money value of current output. So in this payroll example, an individual's saving is matched by a debt from the employer, not by physical goods. But the employer who has incurred that debt to the worker can be expected to hold a matching asset, represented by an increase in working capital. Thus, if we consolidate the accounts of both employer and worker, the worker's saving is matched by the additional working capital. Of course, this is just one simple case. But the essential point is that since transfers of existing assets and the creation of debts net out on consolidation, the national balance sheet must show an increase in aggregate saving identically equal to aggregate current investment, allowing for user cost. This is not a matter of leakages and things. It's a matter of double entry bookkeeping, which you've had a short crash course in. Saving is simply the accounting record of investment. Keynes's investment-saving identity is not the Keynesian income-expenditure identity. Since current investment reflects both expenditure on purchases between firms and user cost, which involves no expenditure, there's only an income-expenditure identity on one of two conditions. Either user cost must be excluded by incorrectly including it with what Keynes calls supplementary cost and treating the depreciation of capital goods as relevant only to net income, or alternatively, user cost must be treated as negative expenditure, even though it involves no sale. There's always, of course, a sales expenditure identity. Now, this may seem a fine semantic point, and I'm certainly not suggesting that the national accounts don't balance, but it draws out the difference between the definitions of income by Keynes and by the Keynesians. The latter define income as consolidated aggregate sales, treating the consumption of stocks as a sale or negative purchase, but neglecting the user cost of fixed capital equipment, in other words, what we call gross domestic product. This is fine as a piece of accounting, but it loses the vital subtlety of Keynes's thought, including the entire supply side and his concept of competitive equilibrium, with flexible prices, of course. So, Having established that income is created by production for money value, the whole of GT Chapter 7 addresses the attempts of various authors, including Keynes himself in his treatise on money, to escape the remorseless bookkeeper's logic of the investment-saving identity. The most important problem lies in the perception of a relationship between saving and changes in the quantity of money and debts, represented by loanable funds theory, which seeks to maintain in a monetary economy the classical linkage between the rate of interest and the rate of saving. Dennis Robertson holds that saving is a form of cash flow, that is, income realised in cash but not spent. And since investment at some point requires finance in cash, it seems reasonable to regard saving as part of the problem of finance. The rate of interest then clears the market for the demand and supply of finance, the demand for finance being driven by expected investment returns, productivity, the supply of finance being determined mainly by decisions to prefer future to present consumption, thrift, in the absence of monetary disturbances. Sounds very plausible. The problem with Robertson's version of loanable funds theory can be understood in terms of these terribly dry accounting concepts as the confusion between income and cash flow, and between the two sides of a balance sheet, between a reserve in the sense of a liability, such as the retained earnings account in our balance sheet, and a reserve in the sense of an asset, which is usually a money balance. Aggregate saving is never independent of aggregate current investment, while saving and money always appear on opposite sides of a balance sheet. Like chalk and cheese, saving and money look very similar, but they cannot legitimately be interchanged or combined. Savings, meaning cumulative saving, despite common usage, are not loanable funds at all. So in this table, saving is 10 units in the period, cumulative saving is 260 units, but savings in the popular sense, i.e. bank balances, have actually declined by £70, we said, didn't we, to £130. Income and saving, while essentially monetary, are still a matter of physical deliveries of newly produced goods, after taking into account the consumption of new and old goods. Cash flows arise only on settlement of debts created by deliveries to customers, i.e. sales, and in logic, they're an entirely separate matter. Once the sale agreements have been made, there is no means by which a change in the terms, including the rate of interest, on which cash is available to pay these debts, can alter the physical deliveries, barring contractual default. And of course, the terms of finance may prevent a firm or person entering into contracts in the first place, including carrying out production at a certain level. And GT Books 3 and 4 address in detail the influence of the rate of interest on the propensity to consume and the inducement to invest. But this does not alter the fact that there is quite simply no direct connection between aggregate expense, cash flow, and income. All three have quite distinct and separate meanings. The significance of the aggregate investment saving value identity, to give it its full name, I think, is far-reaching. In GT Chapter 2, K Keynes identified as central to the neutral economy of the classical theory of employment, the idea that the interest rate is a price which keeps aggregate saving from income in equilibrium with the aggregate current investment of income. In Chapter 6, by careful definition of terms, he has identified that saving has no independent existence and is always purely a reflection of current investment. Saving and current investment are kept in equilibrium by movements not of the rate of interest, but in the level of income. If the spot markets for consumption goods and capital goods in each industry are in competitive equilibrium, there is no sense in which saving and current investment can be equal but not in equilibrium. The existence of a market value for output is a sufficient condition for equilibrium at any time, as he states on page 64. Now, although I believe that this accounting approach, which is embodied in Keynes's chapter 6 and 7, is sufficient to dispatch Robertson's version of loanable funds theory, there is another more subtle version associated with Hicks, Hansen, and the Swedish school. Keynes does not directly address this in the general theory itself, although he did so partly in subsequent articles. The essential proposition of this version of loanable funds theory is that disequilibrium in the goods market, usually expressed as a difference between planned saving and investment, affects the rate of interest. The answer does lie in the general theory, but this is an example of a clash between the two quite different concepts of equilibrium that I've emphasised from the outset of these talks. Hicks is insisting on the Valrasian concept of general equilibrium, which, as I've pointed out, is quite different from Keynes's concept of system equilibrium, and actually inappropriate for the understanding of an entrepreneur monetary economy. Hicks is a more subtle fox than Robertson, and he does not commit the error of confusing contract with cash flow. He's a better accountant. His version of loanable funds theory hinges on Walras' law, that excess demands in all markets must sum to zero. Thus, an excess supply of goods, or an excess of planned saving over planned investment, if you like, must be matched by an excess demand for securities, tending to restore equilibrium in the goods market. According to Hicks, if prices and wages are flexible, changes in the interest rate and relative price structure as a whole make plans consistent, so that in each period, or week as Hicks calls it, investment ex ante equals saving ex ante, as well as ex post. Hansen wrote that Keynes did not see clearly that, quotes, saving and investment, while always equal ex post, are not always or necessarily in equilibrium ex ante. And this is the result of insisting on viewing the concept of effective demand through the lens of the Keynesian cross, as equilibrium income, the point where plans equal outcomes. And in my last talk, I quoted Keynes's rejection of this approach and demonstrated that effective demand and income are quite different animals. They have different shapes, and they're not commensurable. And production time is crucial to understanding the distinction between them. Thus, for Keynes, both effective demand and income are each continuous equilibrium values. But effective demand is not equilibrium income. And income always reflects the reconciliation of plans, i.e. the equilibrium of demand and supply. Income is determined each day as a matter of market period equilibrium in Marshall's sense. That is, spot prices move to clear the market for goods finished that day and on hand. Noting, of course, that the demand includes the reservation demand of dealers deciding to hold stocks rather than throw them on the market to see what they will fetch. The valuation of working capital is more complicated, since it necessarily involves expectation. But under the assumption of perfect competition, another key point, it does have an objective spot equilibrium value. So Keynes can write on page 64, and it's so important I'm going to read the whole passage. It might be, of course, that individuals were so tête-monté in their decisions as to how much they themselves would save and invest respectively, that there would be no point of price equilibrium at which transactions could take place. In this case, our terms would cease to be applicable, since output would no longer have a definite market value. Prices would find no resting place between zero and infinity. Experience shows, however, that this, in fact, is not so, and that there are habits of psychological response which allow of an equilibrium being reached at which the readiness to buy is equal to the readiness to sell. That there should be such a thing as a market value for output is, at the same time, a necessary condition for money income to possess a definite value, and a sufficient condition for the aggregate amount which saving individuals decide to save to be equal to the aggregate amount which investing individuals decide to invest. Clearness of mind on this matter is best reached, perhaps, by thinking in terms of decisions to consume or to refrain from consuming, rather than of decisions to save. A decision to consume or not to consume truly lies within the power of the individual. So does a decision to invest or not to invest. The amounts of aggregate income and of aggregate saving are the results of the free choices of individuals whether or not to consume and whether or not to invest. But they are neither of them capable of assuming an independent value resulting from a separate set of decisions taken irrespective of the decisions concerning consumption and investment. In accordance with this principle, the conception of the propensity to consume will, in what follows, take the place of the propensity or disposition to save. Unquote. I don't know how Hanson could read into this the idea that Keynes did not understand the difference between the identity and equilibrium of investment and saving, except that both Hicks and he had failed to escape from the idea that the only true equilibrium is a Walrasian equilibrium, in which all factors are fully and optimally employed. Yet, Walras' law has no causal force to restore equilibrium. Unemployed workers cannot exercise an excess demand for the goods they are willing to work for. Walras' law corresponds to the concept of ex ante saving, something of which Keynes could make no sense and argued against at length, but unsuccessfully, it seems, in the controversy over loanable funds theory immediately subsequent to the general theory. As we've seen with income and capital, so with ex ante saving, the fact that you can define something does not mean that it exists. Now, next week we'll hear more from Michel Devroy on the difference between the Marshallian and Walrasian approaches to equilibrium. Although Michel takes a different view from me insofar as he considers that Keynes did not succeed in demonstrating the possibility of involuntary unemployment in competitive equilibrium, his insights are, I think, most valuable in helping us to slough off the old classical skins from which Keynes and everyone else has had such a long struggle to escape, if they have escaped at all. Keynes stated that he wrote GT Book 2, and I quote, "to clear up certain perplexities which have no peculiar or exclusive relevance to the problems which it is our special purpose to examine, so that I could not express myself conveniently until I had found some solutions for them," unquote. The underpinning of current macroeconomic theory is a simplified, dynamic, intertemporal, general equilibrium model based on the Swan-Solow growth model, with an aggregate production function, homogeneous output and capital, and saving brought into equilibrium with current investment by the rate of interest. The importance of the subtle problems raised by Keynes in these chapters and of the solutions offered by him has simply not been recognised.